Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Newman, a host on this channel. Today, we'll be speaking with Tanya Harmer about her book, Beatriz Allende, A Revolutionary Life in Cold War Latin America, that's just out this spring from UNC Press. Tanya Harmer is an associate professor of international history at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Tanya, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for inviting me on. It's great to be able to talk to you about it.
So this book is a biography of Beatriz Allende, but I actually wanted to begin by asking a sort of biographical question about you. How exactly did your academic trajectory lead you to this project?
Yeah, no, thanks for the question. There were a few things that led me to be interested in Beatriz. I have to say that this book very much follows on from my first book, which was an international history of Allende's Chile. So the 3 years of the Unidad Popular government in Chile that from 1970 to 73. And it was over the course of writing that book and doing the interviews for that book, primarily with former Cuban intelligence officials, that I first became aware of Beatriz and aware of how she was very significant in the relationships between Chile and Cuba in the 60s and 70s. So I started having questions about her during that first book. She appears in the first book here and there. But she was mentioned in interviews that I did. Her name kept popping up. And I started to get curious, really. I started to think, you know, who was she? How was she able to reach important positions so young? And just by way of kind of introduction for those who haven't read the book, she becomes a very key advisor, confidant to her father during her father's presidency in the early 70s. She was involved in guerrilla insurgencies in the late 60s. She was a key figure of global solidarity networks in the 1970s. And so I started thinking, you know, who was she and how did she get to this position? What were her influences? What was she able to influence? And I have to say, I was also curious because about the time I was hearing about her, not now, it's taken me 10 years to write the book, but around the time I was writing about her, she was someone who was the same, would have been the same age as me. I was just curious about how someone at similar age had such a completely different life and a different experience. So one of it was curiosity about who was this woman, and nothing really had been written about her. The fact that she had died of suicide very young, age 35, in 1977, also had meant that not many people had delved into her past. And then there was the question of opportunity. So in doing the interviews with the people that I was interviewing for the first book, and primarily Beatriz's former husband, Luis Fernandez Oña, I realized I had the opportunity to ask about her, but also possible people who could open doors to others who could I could interview who might be able to share sources. And Luis also was able to share some of her private collection, so her correspondence. And among those, kind of the letters between her and Luis that that he'd saved from the late 60s. And then finally, it was really about, there was an intellectual interest in exploring Cold War history and the history of Chile from new angles. So my first book was very much an international history focused on state-to-state relations, but I became increasingly interested in what Gilbert Joseph and Greg Grandin had called like the internationalization, politicization of everyday life. You know, how did the Cold War contest really affect everyday society, people, and human subjects, right? Human beings, what did it mean to them? There was a kind of a variety of things that led me to start asking questions about her and thinking about this project more broadly.
So before we get into talking about some of the different periods of Beatriz's life, I wondered if you could just sort of give our listeners a little bit of an overview of some of the milestones in Chilean history during the period of her lifetime, from the 1940s up to the 1970s, and how you see your work as, sort of giving maybe some nuance as well as joining a conversation about the global 60s or the long 1960s.
So this is, I mean, it's a book that really charts a revolutionary moment in Chilean history, what I call kind of the rise and fall of a revolutionary moment. This is a moment where you have increasing participation in political life in Chile, political mobilization, and interestingly, youth involvement in politics. It's a much broader view of the revolutionary process that we usually hear about, which is we usually see focus on 1970 to 73, which was when Salvador Allende was elected as the head of a left-wing coalition government and governed until the coup of 1973. But as you say, really in charting this rise and fall of the revolutionary moment in Chile, I'm interested in the long 60s, in positioning that Unidad Popular movement, that Allende's government, in a much broader chronological period. So when I'm talking about the long 60s in Chile, I'm talking about three presidential terms, three governments. So there's the presidency of Jorge Alessandri from 1958 to 1964, a period of really crisis and questioning, really, of the established order, traditional politics that took place in that period. And then the book kind of moves to what I've really come to appreciate as being really transformative moment in Chilean history. Through writing this book, and which I don't think we can understand the 70s without understanding, which was the presidency of Eduardo Frei and the Christian Democratic government from 64 to 70, which brought about or aimed to bring about what was known as a revolution in liberty, a reformist kind of experiment that tried to prevent kind of Marxist socialist revolution from gaining popularity and in the country. We then move on to Allende's government, this incredible period by which a democratically elected government tried to bring about peaceful socialist revolution by democratic means. And of course, we go to the coup of 1973, which was obviously the demise of that experiment. And the book follows Beatrice then into exile in Cuba, where she began helping to lead and participate in resistance to the right-wing dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet that established itself in Chile from 1973 right up until 1990.
Thank you so much. So now let's kind of zoom in a little bit on the life of Beatriz Allende, who I'm not sure we've said is the daughter of Salvador Allende, who was, an important political figure through the time period you're writing about. So the first question I had for you was about kind of her early life and to what extent her experience and her family situation, was it usual or unusual for a young woman from the Chilean upper middle class?
Yeah, and thanks. That's probably where we should have started, really. Who is Beatriz, and what does she represent? What does she do in her life? Well, she's the second daughter of Salvador Allende and Hortensia Bussi, his wife. She grows up in a very middle class world, as you mentioned. She's incredibly influenced by her father, very close to her father, who is has been running for Congress and also president in her early life. So politics is very much part of her daily life, is part of her family life. She says, and I was able to draw on a number of interviews that she gave later on in her life, she herself reflected that she didn't really become politically aware or conscious of politics until she was about 14 or 15. So while she went on election tours or campaign tours with her father, and although politics was present in her home life and her household, she led quite a sheltered life in terms of questioning what her father was campaigning for, or what politics, what was happening in the country. Now, obviously, I would love to have had many more sources to really delve into what happened when she was 14 or 15, when she says her father really explained what was happening to the country. But I had to go and look at the context. I had to think, okay, what is happening at this moment in Chile when she's 14 or 15? And there's a lot that is happening. I mean, for one, Chile has these incredible riots that break out in March, April 1957, and similar in a way to the October 2019 protests in Chile at the moment. They were sparked by rising transport costs, but also kind of anger at the rising cost of living and the way in which the government's efforts to deal with economic and difficulties in the country had been channeled through austerity packages, through cutting back on public spending. So you've got this growing mobilization and students and young people really taking to the streets in 1957. Now, this also dovetails at a moment in which the left is reorganizing after a period of really kind of fragmentation. The Communist Party has been banned for 10 years between 1948 and 1958, was banned in Chile as a result of local and international Cold War pressures, anti-communist kind of pressures. But in 1957, you've got the reconfiguration of the left, the formation of the FRAP, which comes together and nominates Allende, Salvador Allende, Beatriz's father, to stand as a presidential candidate in the 1958 elections that are on the horizon. And so this first chapter then, it shows Beatriz becoming more politically aware and engaging in politics at this very crucial, pivotal kind of election that took place in 1958. Now, what the 58 election does, I mean, it raises expectations. You've got huge mobilization for the FRAP, and Allende comes very close to winning. The disappointment then that accompanies the mobilization after he loses is something that I think is very important to understand if we then want to understand the radicalization of younger Chileans in future years, in the kind of 1960s generation. And that chapter ends with what happens 4 months after Allende loses the elections, which is, of course, the Cuban Revolution and the triumph of Fidel Castro, which I argue throughout the book, what I'm trying to do is trying to understand how the Cuban Revolution, which was such a crucial an influence on Beatriz's life, how the Cuban Revolution, why it had the resonance it did among kind of this revolutionary 1960s generation. And I think unless you understand the tensions already existing in Chile, and also that disappointment and frustration with the loss of the election in 1958, we don't really understand why Cuba suddenly becomes a beacon of hope, as one Chilean described it, a beacon of hope and an alternative that seems to suggest a different path to the one that the Chilean traditional parties, left-wing parties, had been following up to that point. It's not that she was born a revolutionary or born thinking in terms of left-wing politics, despite, you know, even though her father was who he was. But it's what I argue is that actually this political awareness and consciousness comes relatively late, in her adolescence, and it's a process of discovery that she has to go and really discover for herself, rather than just absorbing through hereditary kind of osmosis by listening to kind of conversations around her in the family home.
I think another piece of evidence for that argument that you show is that, in fact, it's when she leaves the family home to go to university in a different part of Chile that, you know, some of her kind of more radical political ideas start to coalesce. So could you talk about how she ends up in Concepción and what's her life as a medical student there like, and how are politics part of that university experience for her?
Yeah, so as well as being influenced by her father and his politics and that being a way into kind of left-wing revolutionary politics for her, she's also very much inspired by her father's medical training and his experience of having been a medical student. I think it's inconceivable to think of why she went into medicine, and she goes to study medicine. This is what she chooses to do without understanding that, you know, admiration she has for her father. And I think also her father's predilection for a particular type of medicine, social medicine, and his interest in public health. So she wants to study medicine, but interestingly, and this is something that I wasn't aware of when I began interviews and started delving into this story, in Chile in 1960, which is when she's applying to university, only 15% of students admitted to medical programs were women. The numbers of women were capped going into university, and the reason for this was that it was expected that women would eventually graduate, they'd go and get married, have children, and leave the profession. So why kind of train them and expend the money and resources on training women? I mean, this didn't happen. You know, those who did go to university stayed in the profession, and Beatrice was one of the few who actually left, but she left for political reasons later on. But because of this quota, the 15%, she doesn't get into her first choice. And her first choice is the University of Chile. It is Santiago, which is where she's living. And she gets a place in Concepción in the south of Chile. Now, in a way, this becomes kind of a serendipitous moment in her life, which is, you know, pivotal, transformational in terms of her politics, as you say. Because in Concepción, as you alluded to, she starts to discover her politics for herself. She's not so much in the shadow of her father. She meets a number of key figures who will be incredibly important figures on the revolutionary left in Chile. I mean, the most important, obviously, being Miguel Enríquez, who becomes a friend of hers and whom she shares kind of political in a political kind of group with at the University of Concepción. But there are other things that happen at Concepción which change her life and give her an awareness of politics, but also of what's happening in Latin America that would never have been predicted when she got the news that she wasn't going to be in Santiago. And that is that in May 1960, there was a huge earthquake that struck southern Chile, the largest ever recorded earthquake actually to date. And this earthquake, she is fine. She leaves Concepción very quickly, and most of students from Concepción are evacuated or leave to go back home if they can. Those from the south had to stay. But Beatrice is one of a few Chilean students from Concepción University who are selected to go to Buenos Aires to receive and collect donations that have been collected for the university to help the university rebuild. There's an enormous outpouring of solidarity and assistance around the world following this earthquake, but very much so in Latin America. And she gets a lift on a postal plane across the Andes with these other students to Buenos Aires. And there she meets other students in Buenos Aires, socialist students. So this is part of a kind of university socialist network. And she meets up with people who had been to Chile for a summer school in early 1960. And in Buenos Aires, she's invited the students are invited to Uruguay, then they're invited to Brazil, then they're invited to Venezuela. And most importantly, they're invited to Cuba. And on the back of this incredible Latin American tour, which is a fundraising tour, but it increasingly becomes a tour in which these students are learning about Latin America, learning about the region, they end up in Havana, arriving just after the first Latin American Youth Congress has started. And this is an incredible event that took place in 1960 that has received very little attention, actually, but which brought together young Latin Americans from all around the region, not just on the revolutionary left, but Christian Democrats, nationalists, reformists, communists of the communist parties, to discuss what was happening in Latin America, to discuss what was happening in Cuba, and to think about what role youth could play in development, in modernity, in thinking about kind of Latin America's future. And it's there she meets Che. You know, she sees at the closing ceremony of the Youth Congress, she sees Fidel. He makes an incredible speech in which he expropriates or announces the expropriation of a number of U.S. businesses. And her companion told me of, you know, the young delegates to this Congress essentially going down to the seafront and seeing the signs, you know, being thrown into over the Malecon into the sea. And she goes back to Concepcion and she becomes, a spokesperson for the Cuban Revolution. I mean, it had been something of interest to her before this, but she discovers it firsthand. And so among the kind of chance influences that that really come to form her own political identity, in which the influence of the Cuban Revolution is central.
So after this time of, sort of being on more on her own in the university setting and that very exciting sounding Latin American tour, her father runs for president again, and she takes on an important role in that campaign. So could you describe for us exactly what this role was and what made her contribution significant this time around?
Yeah. The 1964 election in Chile was incredibly hard fought election. In both candidates that are running, that's Eduardo Frei for the Christian Democrats and her father for the FRAP, both of them are campaigning on an agenda for change. Neither of them are campaigning for the status quo. But what Frei is suggesting is that he will bring forward a reformist revolution in liberty, as I mentioned before. To one that would bring about large-scale change, but without class conflict. In fact, what he ends up doing, or the Christian Democrat campaign, heavily funded by the United States, ends up doing, is actually purporting to bring about to offer a third way, but really politicizing, very vast sectors of the Chilean population, because what they're trying to do is take the campaign to youth sectors, to women's groups, to what were described as marginal sectors. Now, the FRAP is also campaigning in the same kind of respect. I mean, they have been campaigning in poorer communities, trying to win over youth sectors as well. And Beatriz, this 1964 campaign really dovetails it dovetails with where Beatriz is at that moment. I mean, she's just turned 21. She is part of this youth generation that both candidates are trying to win over and mobilize and target as voters. She's also a woman, of course. And the 1964 election, the view was that women had helped bring Alessandri to power, and that women's votes would be the key deciding vote between Allende and Frei in a narrow election. So Beatriz is obviously, she's a woman, but she also starts to be able to, she's interviewed and she starts to speak for her father in terms of his position within the family, his approach to religion, because the left is trying to win over female voters. She appears in a number of she's interviewed as, you know, on questions of Allende in the home, which was thought to appeal to kind of women voters to find out more about his intimate life, his personal life. What she's asked about is quite revealing. She's asked more about her hairstyles and how Allende likes women to do their hair than about her politics. But because she's a medical student, and crucially, unlike her sisters, she's a member of the Socialist Party or the Young Socialists, she also becomes seen very much as kind of the person who's closest to her father politically, a kind of an heir to him, or his kind of. Actually, I mean, what was described very often to me in interviews as the son he never had, which we can come on to discuss maybe a bit later. But the family becomes much more prominent, and a spotlight is shone over them in a way that had never really happened in elections prior to this. And that's because of the gendered aspect of this, the election, and the belief that women voters needed to be won over. More.
So following this election, and following this chapter in the book, you talk about sort of, on the one hand, the sort of everyday rhythms and habits of her medical studies, which are very intense, a sort of growing political involvement on her part, and also her first important romantic relationship. So I wondered if you could tell us how those three pieces are interconnected or not. And are we seeing that politicization of everyday life in the Cold War happening here?
Yeah. I mean, one of the most fascinating aspects to me of writing a biography is that, I mean, and really, it's kind of less of a kind of classic biography in that cradle to grave, but more of a kind of micro history approach to biography, in that I'm interested in her as a means to understanding the times and the world that she lived in. But what is interesting is that you have to go where your subject goes, and your subject goes in ways that you wouldn't think about. When we devise our kind of projects, we tend to think in terms of neat historical categories. We're history of medicine, or history of politics, or history of the environment. The thing about Beatrice is, as a medical student, she forced me to go and understand, that relationship between health and politics. For her, it's so very obvious that the two were very intricately connected for her father as well. But what we see is, as a medical student, and particularly in her internship years, where the students were working in kind of big public hospitals, that these students become directly witness to some of the key kind of strains and pressures facing Chile, and particularly the results of kind of socioeconomic and society inequalities and problems that she really sees through the perspective of health, which has been something I've been thinking about a lot recently in the current situation. And so we see big questions of family planning that the student doctors are dealing with in terms of dealing with the complications arising from illegal abortions in the 1960s, which becomes a crisis of really significant proportions in Chile, and the growing kind of reformist impulses towards family planning that happen in the mid-60s under Frey's administration, and you have this rare consensus in which kind of conservative Cold War politics with regards to family planning dovetail with more progressive kind of left-wing kind of approaches to alleviation of poverty, coming together at a particularly interesting moment when it comes to public health. But for Beatrice, public health, or being a doctor, was always about helping people, obviously helping people, but she saw health as being directly connected to the socioeconomic conditions in which people lived. They were being trained in the 1960s to think very much in terms of health, not in terms of just disease and illness, but in terms of the broader sociological and economic conditions that people were living in as well. So as a medic, she also goes out to work in an internship, a rural an internship in another province. They go out to work. She goes to Melipilla, a municipality further away from Santiago, where she comes into contact with different types of medicine and different kinds of rural kind of population as well. So, yeah, there are a number of connections between what her politics and how they're evolving and her medical training as well. In terms of her relationships, her friendship groups, I mean, her first real proper relationship and her first husband is a leader of the socialist youth or someone very involved in socialist youth politics, and very much in terms of who she's socializing and how they're socializing, which is very much centered around politics. It's centered around political activism, mobilization of the mid 1960s, and it makes a lot of sense that this is where she finds kind of love, her first significant relationship. It's also politics which starts to pull them apart, actually, and starts to create tensions in the relationship further along.
So I'd like to talk about the years 1967, 68, 69, maybe all together.
Yeah, of course.
She takes another life-changing trip to Cuba, gets into a new relationship there. But the question I'd really like to ask you is, how revolutionary did Beatriz want to be? Sort of what kind of political actor was she aiming to be? And was she able to sort of practice her politics in the way that she aspired to during that era?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most decisive things that happens is Che Guevara's death in 1967 and his involvement in Bolivia from 66 to 67. This is an incredibly important influence and moment for Beatriz and for the revolutionary left as well. There's a radicalization of politics in Chile, which I won't go into at the moment, but Che Guevara's death is, and this comes on the back of his incredible message to the Tricontinental to create two, three, many Vietnams, this call to arms for revolutionaries in the region. Che Guevara's death is a very, very moving, mobilizing moment for many young Latin Americans. And she goes to Cuba in the immediate aftermath of his death. And one of the things she's asking is, how can I follow in his footsteps? How can I be like Che? Because this is what Fidel says, you know, after his death. He says, we as revolutionaries, we must aspire to be like him. Seremos como el Che, we will be like Che. And this is a moment where she asks, okay, I'm ready. Will you train me? I want to train as a guerrilla insurgent and I want to follow him. Now, she does link up with a new guerrilla insurgency in Bolivia, led by Inti Peredo, but she's told that she will not be trained as a guerrilla insurgent, that she will work in the urban underground in communications and logistics. And there are two reasons for this. One is that she's her father's daughter and he is a prominent political figure in Chile, and they worry about the complications. The Cubans worry about the complications that her involvement might cause for her father. But the other reason is because she's a woman, and women were not being trained to go and fight in insurgencies on the whole. They were predominantly considered more appropriate to work in communications and intelligence. And this really is not what she wants to be like Che. So I talk about, you know, this is a book that tells you what it's like to be a female revolutionary in the age of Che Guevara. Well, it's the same as it is for male revolutionaries in terms of the inspirations and the motives that are leading her to want to join these guerrilla insurgencies. But it's different in that she is told no. She is told that women are not suitable for these kind of for the kind of physical, kind of heroic guerrilla actions, and so she's told to go back to Santiago, where she forms a very important part of the rear guard, helping to support those who go to Bolivia in this second insurgency. It's a disaster, this second insurgency, but she's there kind of providing radio signaling, transporting arms back and forth to the Bolivian border, organizing safe houses, using Radio Havana to decode messages for those in Santiago. So that's where she is really in the late 60s. She's very focused on Bolivia. And she's focused on Bolivia because she believes that, or the Cubans believe that, that is where a regional kind of revolutionary movement can start. That Chile doesn't really have the conditions for revolution in the same way.
So how then does she transition into taking an important role in supporting and maybe even advising her father when Allende does eventually win the presidency?
She's very reluctant, really, to become very involved in his 1970 campaign. She's very skeptical that he's going to win, or that, you know, he's going to be able to assume the presidency if he does. I think to understand the reasons why she really becomes an active and very central figure in his campaign team, and then goes to La Moneda and works for him as one of his private secretary, but as you say, a role that was kind of also advisory in some ways, or at least very important in terms of supporting his presidency. The reasons are, one is that the insurgency of Bolivia by 1970 has run into just really catastrophic kind of roadblocks. Inti Peredo is killed. The urban networks are discovered. This insurgency, the members of the insurgency are on the run or they defect. Even the Cubans have kind of turned their back, and they're advising, as well as, you know, those within Chile are turning back to Chile and thinking, okay, maybe we can have more of an influence here. The other thing that is very important is her father has a heart attack on the campaign trail in early 1970. And it is a personal love and concern for her father and his campaign team, and the fear that he needs to be protected and supported, that really leads her back into supporting him, or leads her to stand by him in the way she does. One of the things she does is she's very worried about his security. She helps organize a personal bodyguard for him. And in this, she brings in many of her friends who had been involved in the Bolivian revolutionary insurgency. And so they start to coalesce around her father and create kind of a security force for him. From within La Moneda, when she's a private secretary, she works with a team of other women in the private secretariat, very gendered kind of office that was there. But she becomes an unofficial what was described to me as a parallel foreign minister. So obviously she doesn't deal with state-to-state relations, but she becomes a bridge for her father, or a kind of the link for her father with the Cuban regime, but also with other revolutionary groups within Latin America. She also becomes a bridge for her father between the UP, the Unidad Popular, and also the MIR, so the far left group, or the extra parliamentary group that Miguel Enriquez is heading by the 1970s. And one of the things she tries and does is to make sure that these two groups don't break apart. So Allende and the UP is an incredible case of very different left-wing factions trying to govern and lead the country towards a kind of democratic, peaceful road to socialism, but believing in very distinct and different ways to get there. And Allende has to tread a very fine line to keep these different factions together. And Beatriz becomes a very important asset to him in being able to keep the revolutionary left on board, or to at least convene meetings and to convene ways in which these groups can talk to each other. So those are some of the ways in which she participates in security, in terms of a bridge to revolutionary groups and in terms of kind of this link to the revolutionary left.
Could you talk about sort of where she was and what happened to her on September 11th, 1973, and her experience in exile? How does that exit happen?
Well, she would have, because of her training, she would have very much liked, or not liked, but she expected to be next to her father, fighting by his side, Patria o Muerte, against the coup, which when it struck, and it was all expected to strike. And she goes to La Moneda on the day of the 11th of September, despite her father's efforts to prevent her from going. And one of the reasons he wants to prevent her from going is that she's his daughter and he wants to protect her. She's also 7 months pregnant on the day of the coup. This does not stop her going and wanting to be by her father's side, but her father is very concerned that women should be protected and they should be able to leave La Moneda. They should leave La Moneda. They should be allowed to before the bombing of the palace starts. He begs her and her sister, who is also there, and the other women to leave. She desperately tries to stay, but in the end leaves. And many have suggested, and I think this is true, that she never forgives herself for not having been able to stay with her father until the end, until, you know, La Moneda is bombed and her father most probably commits suicide as troops storm the building and take it over. She goes into exile. She goes to the Cuban embassy, where she meets with her Cuban husband, and they go into exile in Havana. And she becomes a key figure in organizing a unified left resistance, or a coordinated left-wing resistance to the dictatorship. Now, I say coordinated or united, I mean, there's a united left label put on this, but one of the things that she finds increasingly hard is dealing with the left-wing splits and the factional fighting that goes on with the left after the coup, are largely to do with kind of arguments over what went wrong and who had been wrong, who had been right in the period leading up to the coup, and what should then, how they should then really effectively confront the dictatorship.
So I'd like to ask now, knowing that this story ends in a sort of, well, an incredibly painful and tragic way with Beatriz taking her own life, can you tell us a little bit about the process of doing research to be able to contextualize or shed some light on that personal decision she made?
Yeah. So this is a very difficult thing to write about, and it was a very difficult story to be able to research as well. I mean, I never had access to any kind of medical records in Cuba, nor did I really go kind of trying to probe someone's very personal medical history. The sources I was able to draw on to understand or to tell that part of her story, that talk about her death, were mainly to do with, on the one hand, her private correspondence or the correspondence that remained in the collection, the private collection that I was able to access. And in those letters, she does talk about her physical and mental state. And you can see by 1977, her concerns, the way in which she's writing about how she feels in Cuba, are changing. and particularly how she's feeling about what's happening in Chile, what's happening to the left, and really her huge disillusionment about the possibilities for overcoming and overthrowing the dictatorship. So that was on the one hand, I had those sources. On the other hand, I had the interviews that I did. And one of the main sources for the book were extensive oral histories with many of her friends, family. And although they couldn't tell me what was inside Beatrice's mind when she made this decision, they together do help to piece together the circumstances, the context in which she made this choice. Now, she did write a letter, a suicide note, which she addressed to Fidel, and I wasn't able to read that. But I did speak to people who had read it, and they were able to shed some light on what it said. So, I mean, in terms of the process by which I was able to write about this, I had to address it. It was something that obviously came up. And in all of the interviews, and when you're writing a biography, it had to be addressed. But a lot of it has to come down to conjecture, really, at the end, about how her friends, how her family interpreted that decision, and through her correspondence, piecing together really what it was that led her to that, to take her own life.
Thank you for speaking about that. You've mentioned, the interviews that you've done as being one of the important sources. Were there any others that you sort of felt like were absolutely critical to making this biography possible?
Yeah, I mean, her letters, the access I had to her private correspondence was key. And I said that there are different types of letters here. I mean, one of them were the private love letters that she wrote to Luis in the late 60s and 70s, in which there's a coded references to the insurgency she's involved in. And also she talks about this political situation in Chile, as well as her longing for Cuba, the way in which she's thinking about Cuba and the revolution there. The other correspondence is the solidarity correspondence. I mean, the thing about writing about solidarity and about the process she was involved in is that solidarity moved forward through written words. This is how people communicated with each other across continents, across oceans. So the paper trail there is extensive in helping to piece together her role within this solidarity movement and on the left. It's far harder to find sources about covert revolutionary insurgencies. Covert revolutionaries don't tend to write down what they're doing and why. And so in those respects, interviews were important. The other source that I found really much more useful than perhaps I had envisaged when I went into this project were newspapers. I'd used a lot of media sources, a lot of newspapers to give me access to context, interviews that were conducted by the media at the time. But I mean, the book draws on, to do a kind of history like this, it draws on what I could find, from everything from CIA intelligence files to British foreign diplomatic kind of observations of what was happening in Chile, to people's memoirs, to interviews, to these love letters, the most intimate kind of private love letters as well.
It sounds like a challenging and quite monumental endeavor, but the results I really enjoyed reading, and it's been great speaking with you about them. I did have, a sort of more abstract question. I wanted to know what have been sort of some of the particular satisfactions that you've had from writing a biography, which is a different genre, than the monograph or some of the other genres that we tend to write in as historians?
For me, history is first and foremost, has always been about writing about people, about humans, about the way in which they interact with the societies and the context around them. And this really allowed me to do that. The other satisfaction I had was really in in really being able to delve in and probe the role that women played in the revolutionary left and in the Cold War. Women have been kind of silent in many kind of histories of revolution and political change. I mean, this is changing. There's some incredible scholarship of women and gender and the Cold War and revolution and recent Latin American history. But for me, choosing this incredible woman, and she's complex and contested and flawed as well, but choosing this woman and following her journey really allowed me to kind of explore new avenues that I had not really thought about. And as I said, I really do think of this as a kind of micro history, as a life and times, in which the times really in which she lived came into view more and more as the project continued.
Thank you so much. Would you share with us what your next project is, what you're working on right now?
Well, having just finished, I can't say that I've got a definitive project in mind. This summer, before COVID-19 broke out, was going to be a moment of reading, reflection, and really planning for the next project. I've got two ideas. One, I think, is to look more seriously at the role that the Vietnam War had in Latin America and in influencing political change and society in the 60s and 70s. I feel there's a big historiographical gap when it comes to understanding what Vietnam's significance was. And the Beatrice book really kind of pushed me towards that in terms of how Vietnam intersects with the various kind of political choices and ideas that she's involved in. And the second one is to look more closely at women in revolutionary groups, particularly on the revolutionary left, but particularly those who fought in the resistance against Pinochet, either in terms of solidarity activists or on the ground, clandestinely in the political parties, and particularly the Frente Patriótico Manuel Rodríguez. I feel like there's much more to learn about women's roles. And one of the things that I say in the book is that, you know, we need to move away from looking at, obviously, the leaders. There's been great work on rank and file, but I feel like there's a place for the secretaries and the urban underground and those who are involved in communications and logistics, like Beatrice, who really were central to making kind of some of these revolutionary operations possible, and so that is another possible project, or maybe both of them will be something I work on together. Things that I work on together.
Well, those sound like very exciting avenues, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who's looking forward to those whenever the time comes. So, thank you so much, Tania, for speaking with us today. We've been talking to you about your book, Beatrice Allende, A Revolutionary Life in Cold War Latin America. And it's been my pleasure to learn a bit more about it with you.
Thanks very much, Rachel. Thanks for having me on.